accession number 20806, Reel 1.
Les Harvey, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Where? Hertfordshire.
Whereabouts in Hertfordshire?
Where?
Oh, I see.
Yes. It's a musical joke.
Which year was this? Which year was this?
May, 19... the month of May, 1920.
Did both your mother and father come from where?
No, my mother came from Bittenden in Kent. My father was born in Bromley.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a pianoforte restorer.
Which school did you go to in Ware?
The Cooper Boys School. Well, actually, it was not in Ware, it was in Hertford. I used to cycle 3 miles every day.
How old were you when you finished there?
At 10.
Where did you go to after that?
Well, then we came to London, to Greenwich.
Whereabouts in Greenwich?
Trafalgar Road. Christchurch Boys' School I went to there.
How old were you when you completed your schooling?
16.
So that must have been 36.
1936.
Did you get a job?
Yes. I went as an apprentice to Phillips and Paris MR, or Miles Aircraft, at Reading.
Doing what exactly?
Well, all phases of aeronautical engineering.
So how did you come to be in the RAF?
Well, part of my job was in the final assembly hangar and seeing the production test pilot off on his test flights with the Miles Magister, which we were turning out. And I noticed a number of people, young boys or young men, are turning up at weekends flying the firm's aircraft, and I said to Skinner, what are these chaps doing? And he explained, he said, oh, well, I'm members of the RAF Volunteer Reserve. So he said, it's a thing you ought to consider, because unless I miss my guess, this country's going to be at war with Germany within the next 12 months. So if you're in the RAF VR, when the balloon does go up, you'll be in something which you want to be in. You won't be gang-pressed into the Navy or the Army. And so it turned out. One of the smartest moves I ever made.
When did you join the RAF VR?
October 1938.
Was it easy to get in?
No.
What did you have to do?
It was a selection board. And they had, I think it was 36 people interviewed. I think about 4 were selected.
And what happened once you were selected?
Went back home, or back to my digs as it was then, and carried on in the normal way in the factory. At that time I was an engine installation on Miles Magisters, trainers.
But didn't you get any training in RAFVR pre-war?
Oh yes. We used to attend lectures every 2 or 3 evenings a week. And then flying on at the weekends.
So you learnt to fly pre-war?
Oh, yes. And I went solo on April the 7th, I think it was, 1939.
What kind of aircraft did you learn in?
In a Miles, first of all, a Miles, Miles Hawk. And then the successor to that was the Miles Magister.
Did you find it easy to learn how to fly?
Oh, yes.
And did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes.
Under what circumstances?
Well, I was at home in London that weekend, because when the 1st of September I had received my mobilisation papers, and was told to cease my civilian job and to stand by for further instructions. And so I went home to my parents' home in London, and it was on the, I heard the Chamberlain on the news on the radio.
How did you feel about it?
I was excited.
Any sense of dismay?
No. As I say, excitement. I'm thinking at last all the training that I was doing was going to be put to good use.
What happened to you after that? Did the war affect you at first?
No. They sent us. We were sent down to, after a few weeks at home, we were sent down to Bexhill-on-Sea, to what was known as the ITW, Initial Training Wing. And that was in the Sackville Hotel on the seafront, now an old people's home. I'm going to be there until January 1940. And then from January 1940, we're sent up to number 10 SFTS at Service Flying Training School at Turn Hill, flying Harvards, which is the more advanced aircraft. Where I completed my ab initio training before the war, of course.
What did you think of the standard of training you were getting at this time?
Very good. Very good.
And the next step after Turn Hill?
Turn Hill, in July 1940, fall of France, we were sent down to Ashton Down, which was known as the Spitfire Pool. It was a forerunner of what they call the OTUs, the Operational Training Units. But I was lucky to get out of there with my life, because we were only there for 5 days, and I was on 3 funerals. Because they were equipped with Spitfires. But also on the same airfield, they were using short-nosed Blenheim medium bombers. And the bombers, of course, coming out on their long circuitous approach, and the Spitfires doing their fighter turns on landing on top of them, and people were getting killed right, left and centre.
Which airfield was this?
Ashton Down.
And this was the Spitfire Pool?
Spitfire.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, somebody woke up to the fact that the killing rate was so severe that they decided to take the Spitfires out of Ashton Down and exchange them with Harden in Cheshire, which had Hurricanes. And the Hurricanes were sent down to take the place of the Spitfires. So I had half my time at Ashton Down on Spitfires and the other half on Hurricanes. And my total time when I left the place was 4 hours, 20 minutes on a Spitfire and 4 hours on a Hurricane.
Which aircraft did you prefer?
The Spitfire.
For what reason?
It's more agile. Hurricane was a good gun platform, likewise to the Spitfire, but the Hurricane had the edge on the Spitfire. It felt more stable, especially on the ground. The Spitfire on the ground was dreadful, owing to its narrow undercarriage and the difficulty of forward view. The Hurricane one was sitting more upright, and one had a better view and a much wider track undercarriage. It was much more stable on the ground than the Spitfire. But the opposite came into effect when they got airborne. The Spitfire, once it got off the ground, was an absolute bird. And the Hurricane felt more like a cart horse in comparison. I always think of the two as one as a racehorse and the other as a cart horse. Maybe unfair to the Hurricane, but since you ask me.
So when did you go to a squadron?
Squadron. August, the end of August, 1940. Hornchurch.
What squadron was this?
Number 54.
What kind of reception did you get when you went to the squadron?
Oh, the CO said to me, "How much time have you got on Spitfires, Harvey?" And I said, "About 4 hours, 20 minutes." And he said, "What?" I said, "But I've also got 4 hours on Hurricane as well." "Oh, bully for you," he said. "It's a total of 8 hours, 20 minutes. I don't know who sent you here." He said, "We haven't got time to train you. Normally, new pilots coming in, we train them for a few weeks. But we're so busy here that we haven't got time to train you." So after a few days, I was sent back to Aston Down. I spent another week there.
And then went back to Hornchurch.
But by the time I returned, most of the heavy fighting had ceased or tapered off. And the squadron was moved up to Catterick for a rest. And of course I went with them.
How did you feel when the squadron commander said that to you?
Said what?
About your inexperience.
Well, I agreed with him.
According to your logbook, you went to Catterick about the 20th of September.
Yes.
Any incidents that happened to you at Catterick?
The great interest was the one at Hornchurch, but I don't think it's logged in there. I went up with Al Deer on a reconnaissance trip round the area to get the feel of things. And we ran into a cloud of 109s, and we were chased down from 25,000 feet. And I remember coming down in an almost terminal velocity dive and pulling out and seeing the Bofa guns on the gun platform, which was in the Thames estuary. And I saw that flash by, and I looked at the airspeed indicator and saw that I was still doing 400 miles per hour.
What was the outcome of that?
Well, 2109s that were following us failed to pull out. And they both went in.
Have you any memories of Al Deer?
Oh, very much so. Delightful memories. A wonderful man. Was a leader. I would follow him anywhere. My only regret was the fact that it was such a short period of time with him.
Any stories about him?
Oh, I don't think so.
Was he just like an Englishman, or
was he was a New Zealander?
That's what I mean. Were there any characteristics which marked him out from an Englishman?
No. He's a great fellow.
Then I think, any other incidents from when you were with 54 Squadron?
Whilst we were at Catterick, I was called into the CO's office. And he said, "Oh, you're posted." I said, "Posted? Where? Why?" And he said, it's nothing to do with me. He said, "Don't blame me." He said, it's a signal from group. And they want experienced combat pilots to train Polish pilots in Northern Ireland in 245 Squadron at Aldergrove. So I was whisked over to Aldergrove.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I was sad to be losing 54, obviously.
What rank did you have at the time?
At the time I was sergeant pilot.
How did Aldergrove compare with Hornchurch?
Oh, obviously there was no comparison. It was out of the front line. It was very quiet. Hornchurch, of course, was in the 11 group.
And you were training Polish pilots?
Yeah.
What were they like?
Oh, they were very likeable. They were, like myself, they had very limited experience in Poland, and of course practically nothing on English on the RAF aeroplanes. One vivid experience was the last experience that I flew at Aldergrove with two Poles. We went up onto 30,000 feet on a battle climb practice. And instructions in the authorization book were to, at 30,000 feet, to make our way back to base individually. But after the Poles had, when we'd all broken up, or the three of us had broken up, it was a beautiful day, but I noticed out to the west there was a vast cloud, barrier of cloud coming, a blanket of cloud coming across from the Atlantic. And I suddenly realised that if I didn't get down very smartly, I was going to get having trouble finding my way back to the airfield. So I descended over the Irish Sea, and at the same time I realised that my fuel was getting very low. And so I called on up for a practice homing for a DHF station. Fortunately, they had a mobile caravan, a DF Homer, on the end of Belfast Lock. And it's the only call sign, of all the call signs I used in the Royal Air Force, it's the only ones I can remember to this day, Woodlands. So when I called up Woodlands for an emergency homing, they gave me a bearing, which I flew on. And at the same time as they gave me the directions to return to Aldergrove, the engine cut out. And I was in cloud. But amazingly enough, I found myself right bang over the centre of the runways. Landed, no problems at all. But the two Poles, apparently, had landed, but one had landed in the Isle of Mull, and the other one was interned in Southern Era. No blame attached to me, of course, because we were told to report back individually.
Was he ever released from internment?
I do not know what happened. I do not know the outcome of that.
How long were you doing this job for?
Oh, only a short time. Then I was posted to I had a problem with the fact that I was borrowed the engineer officer's motorcycle to go into Belfast one evening, and on the way back I hit the barrier, which was just outside the camp, which was a great big concrete block. And when I left, it had a red hurricane lamp on the top. But when I came back, the hurricane lamp was unlit or missing. And I didn't see this obstruction. Smashed into it, broke my left patella, kneecap in the left leg, which put me in a hospital in Stranmillis in Belfast. And I was operated on there by a marvellous surgeon called name of Ian Fraser, a major. And after I came out of hospital, I was sent for rehabilitation to the RAF rehabilitation unit in Blackpool.
Did you make a full recovery?
Yes, but I didn't fly again until I think it was May or June the following year. And I was posted down to 601 Squadron at Duxford.
What were they equipped with?
Well, they had Hurricane 2s. But they were re-equipping at that time with the American Era Cobra, which was the first tricycle undercarriage fighter in the RAF.
What did you think of the Era Cobra?
Well, it was underpowered. It's far too heavy. And it was unsuitable for fighter interceptions. It was ideal for what happened to it subsequently. It was sent to Russia. And the Russians, of course, thought they were marvellous for tank busting, ground strafing.
What did you think of the facilities at Duxford for pilots?
Well, I was only there, I think, for about 6 weeks. But it was a big airfield, and it's the only airfield where I have taken off with a full squadron of 12 aircraft and landed with a full squadron, which is unusual.
Did you run into the enemy at all whilst you were at Duxford?
Well, we were doing channel sweeps whilst we were converting to the Aero Cobra. We were doing channel sweeps. And I remember Stanford Tuck was the station commander, and I was appointed as his number two. And I have very vague memories of time at Duxford. It was only a few weeks there.
Any memories of Stanford Tuck?
Not really.
What happened after 601 Squadron?
I was posted to, they wanted volunteers for North Africa.
So did you volunteer for North Africa?
Well, I was more or less told to volunteer. It was a question of go. Myself and a flying officer were posted out together. We went out on we were flown up in a skewer by a naval pilot up to Liverpool and put on a boat. And actually it was a captured French merchantman called the Chantilly. I've never forgotten that thing. It was a coal burner, and its maximum speed was 7 knots. And we were in a 63-ship convoy, went out towards America, and took us 3 weeks. And then we came back in towards, to avoid the U-boats. We went almost across the other side of the Atlantic, and then came back into Freetown. And somebody realised that we were only 7 RAF pilots on board this ship. And they thought, well, these people are urgently required in North Africa. We're never going to get them there with this thing. So they transferred us to another boat, which was a marvellous thing. It was a Belgian refrigerated meat carrier, which had only been built in 1938. And that thing could do 20-odd knots. And, of course, we went unescorted with the high speed that this vessel was capable of. And we went into Takoradi on the Gold Coast. From there, we were flown up into Dakotas by Americans as far as Khartoum. The Americans were not allowed to fly further north than Khartoum at that time, because they didn't come, of course, into the war until December. And this was November. And I think we were supposed to be transferred onto one of the Nile steamers. But then somebody realised that it was 1,000 miles, it would take another week before we got to Cairo. And then it was decided to stop the South Africa mail run, which was operated, of course, by the flying boats. They turned off all the army colonels and people going on leave, and we took their place. So, of course, we arrived in style in Cairo within a few hours. And from there, it was on a train out to Western Desert.
Which squadron did you join?
94 Squadron, Hurricanes.
Whereabouts in the Western Desert was this?
Martin Baghouch.
What facilities were there?
It was just a flat sand area. I think it was known as 103 LG landing ground. I think it was 103.
From your logbook, it appears it was the 17th of November, 1941.
That would be about it. I was amazed to see we arrived in moonlight. And I said to the adjutant, I could see the hurricane silhouetted against the moonlight. And I said to him, well, these are Hurricane 1s, aren't they? And he said, yes, we've just been re-equipped. I said, re-equipped? what were you using before? He said, gladiators. And gladiators? I was like, he said, well, what have you been flying? I said, air cobras. He said, well, what are they?
You've put here in the logbook that on the 29th of November, you've put close escort, Maryland's bombing west of El Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
What happened on that occasion?
Well, it was just a routine escort job. We used to fly very close to the bombers.
And the next day, the 30th, you've put alarming patrol over 122 landing ground.
Mm-hmm.
What's alarming?
El Alamein, is it?
You put, it's A-L-A-R-M-N.
Alarm?
Yes. But with an N on the end. How did you like operating in the Western Desert?
It's exciting.
Any incidents that stick out in your mind?
Not really. Mostly the glare of the sun was the main problem, looking for the enemy, which is always a problem, because that's where they came, and out of the sun. Every fighter pilot, whether he's German or English, wants to take advantage of the sun, naturally.
On the 8th of December 1941, you've put escort Boston photographing west of El Gobi, jumped by 109Fs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that incident?
No. I cannot remember the details of it.
Did you ever shoot any enemy aircraft down at that time?
Yes, but they weren't confirmed.
What kind of aircraft were they?
I hit a Ju-88, I remember. It damaged him slightly. There's smoke coming out from one engine.
Did the desert conditions have a bad effect on the engines and on the aircraft?
Oh, yes. Well, not a bad effect. I mean, inasmuch as it was always a problem, sand getting in, especially later on. The boost controls, we get sand on them, and they controlled aneroids, which open and close the fuel supply. And we had quite a lot of problems until they fitted what they called, there's a thing known as the Aboukir filter was fitted. But in aircraft, it took a while for England to realise that the conditions were different in Africa. And it was necessary to fit these filters. So we lost quite a few aircraft and pilots until these filters had been fitted. Because engines used to cut on takeoff, and a very good friend of mine was killed on one of those. Dennis Belcham.
On the 12th of January 1942, you've put top cover to 260 Squadron,
mm-hmm.
jumped by 109Fs,
mm-hmm.
hit by cannon in reserve tank and port wing,
mm-hmm.
machine went into spin and caught fire,
mm-hmm.
bailed out at 1,000 feet, picked up by 11th Hussars in Honey Tank, Sergeants Waitman and Wood, force landed, Mike Maxwell and Ford are bailed out, Ford are killed, rest okay. Mm. Do you remember that incident?
Oh, very much so.
Can you take me through what you remember of that, please?
Well, all I remember of that was the fact that the immense surprise, because we had the sun behind us. And, of course, we were bounced. The enemy, of course, as usual, came out of the sun. I didn't even see them. But I heard a voice came over the RT, 6 o'clock, above. And directly I heard this, of course, I whipped into a tight left-hand turn and was hit immediately in the port wing, which went up like a corrugated roof. Then a cannon shell came in over my left shoulder, into the instrument panel, and straight into the reserve fuel tank. And of course, the whole thing was like sitting in front of a blowtorch.